Welcome to Face the Jury, a podcast dedicated to confronting the issues of medical malpractice in America, what it is, how to spot it, and how to protect you and your family from medical negligence. I'm your host, Lloyd Bell. Today, we have a very special guest, a friend of mine who comes to us from across the country up in the great northwest of Alaska, Meg Simonian, Margaret Simonian. Everybody knows her as Meg. Was nice enough to join us today and share with us some of her experiences trying cases in Alaska. I'm going to give a little bit of introduction to my friend before we get started. Meg is an attorney, a partner, name partner at the firm of Dillon Finley and Simonian PC in Anchorage, Alaska. She is widely considered to be one of Alaska's top trial lawyers who focuses primarily on medical malpractice as well as catastrophic injury cases. Meg has achieved some of the largest verdicts in Alaska history in both state and federal court. She is a native of Alaska, went to undergraduate at University of Alaska, and then went on to law school in the great Northeast and Northeastern University School of Law in Boston. She clerked at the Anchorage Superior Court. She worked as a public defender in the felony division. She has a wealth of trial experience, and I'm very pleased to welcome you, Meg, to Face the Jury. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Lloyd.
We met each other through the Inner Circle. Meg is a recent member of the Inner Circle, and we were talking probably at lunch or at some event, and we kind of gravitated toward the topic of jury selection, and it's an area that I know I'm always focused on and fascinated by people's different approaches. And one of the things and the reasons I am so excited to have you on the episode today is to talk about your perspective on jury selection and talk about some of the approaches that you use that have been so successful in your career. So before we do that, Meg, give us a little bit more about your background. Tell us the story of Meg.
Well, I was born and raised in Anchorage, Alaska, which everybody, you know, always elicits a, oh my gosh, it's a great way to introduce yourself to people. And I'm from a big family. I went to school out of state, but came back. Alaska's a place of extremes. So we have extreme weather. We have extreme light. We have all these things that bring you close to danger and risk, but also the comforts of an actual city or town, and lots of wide open spaces. I have five kids, which also usually elicits a gasp.
What's the age range?
They range from 27 to two 13-year-old twins. So,
oh wow!
I had my first baby in law school, so I've been a mother as long as I've been a lawyer. So, and both inform everything I do, probably.
Of course, I hear five children. I'm thinking that's a perfect size for a focus group to present your cases and get feedback.
Right, it is, and it's a great focus group to try to make sure that you're simply describing your case and using non-medical terms.
Exactly. Well, tell us how you came to be a lawyer and go on that path, and particularly how you gravitated towards being a trial lawyer and working in medical malpractice, not the easiest area to practice law.
Oddly, because neither of my parents graduated from high school, I always wanted to be a lawyer. Nobody in my family, I come from a big family, had gone to college. I just, from a young age, was told I should be a lawyer. So I don't know if that's because I was sassy or argumentative, but people have told me that forever. So I thought, oh, maybe I should be a lawyer. And then when I realized what a lawyer, I thought I realized what a lawyer did, I just thought that's what I wanted to do. So I've been lucky enough, I think, to always want to do legal work. And then when you get a little closer to making that decision, I knew always I wanted to be in the courtroom. I just knew that. And I thought at first I was going to be a prosecutor. That was my plan. And then I went to law school and did internships at a prosecutor's office and at the public defender's office, and felt much more at home in the public defender's office, oddly. And I think that and I loved that work. It was such great work. I loved the camaraderie of it. I loved the pace of it, which is very rapid. Mm-hmm. But it also was so challenging to leave the work in the office. And it was also so challenging with the young family. And so I decided to go into civil work, and I was lucky enough to work at Friedman, Rubin & White as an associate. not doing medical malpractice work, but doing mostly insurance bad faith work at that time, and completely, you know, carrying senior attorneys' bags to the courtroom kind of thing. And then, but it was a
very entry level.
And, sure. But with great mentors at that firm, including Jeff Rubin and Rick Friedman, and Jim McComas was of counsel, just like some of the best lawyers around in the country.
What a gift to be exposed to lawyers of that caliber and capability at such an early age. Cause you had more of a plan probably than I did coming along. I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do except the courtroom. I didn't know if that, what context that would be, whether, you know, whether it's in the criminal system or civil system, but your story sounds familiar, not the five kids part, but the path that you've been on. Well, it's great that you could be here. And the topic today that I am really interested in exploring with you is the topic of jury selection or voir dire or voir dire, depending on what part of the country you live in. So for our listeners who may not be as familiar with that phrase and what it means, tell us what it means to you and how you approach jury selection.
Well, in Alaska, we say voir dire. Mm-hmm. And we are allowed to voir dire, at least in state court. As you know, in federal court, that's always a challenge. But what voir dire means is picking the jury. That's really what it means. And it's the only time in the trial process that, as a lawyer, you get to actually have a conversation with jurors and speak to them and talk to them and ask questions where they respond. So that's essentially what it is. Of course, it's like, in trial practice craft, probably the most talked about, written about, and thought about aspect of the trial, because it's so critical.
And what's your approach? I mean, how do you prepare for jury selection? And then I want to talk to you about how you execute. How do you, obviously you are very good at communicating and engaging, but I'm interested in your particular process.
I always try to get the other side to agree to a jury questionnaire.
Why is that important?
A jury questionnaire is important. And they do have to, in our system, they do fill out a very, very brief jury questionnaire that tells you if they're married, how many kids they have, their job sort of thing. But that's it. It's purely demographic. An actual jury questionnaire that would include some of the questions that might identify jurors who have a bias to either side is super important before you get there, because for two reasons. It can identify people who may not have a bias and who you don't want to spend a lot of time with, but that could be risky. But it definitely can sometimes help you identify people who you know you need to talk to, and who, based on the questionnaire alone with, you know, juror research, which is the next process, can be the jurors you're afraid of and that you definitely need to spend time talking to.
You say afraid of. What do you mean? What jurors would cause you fear if they were to be seated as on your jury?
We want a fair jury. We want a fair fight. And so the jurors that you're afraid of are the people who have biases that can't give you that fair fight, no matter what you say. We know from neuroscientific research that the way people make decisions is so much quicker and so less rational than we all think it is, that the judges and the jurors themselves are not aware of how much a bias can impact how they even hear the evidence around them. So that's the juror you're afraid of, is at least trying to find the person who has a bias who is going to be impossible to convince, because they're only going to look at the evidence that supports their bias or their biased view.
You're exactly right. And what you're saying resonates. And what I found too is that the word bias carries weight. So we started avoiding that word, because when people think of bias, their minds typically go to either, you know, racial bias or, you know, sex bias or some sort of,
yes,
you know, almost universally acknowledged, you know, bad thing, but every bias isn't bad.
No.
And tell us about that.
Well, and I agree with you totally using that word bias. And that's the problem with using a word like that, is because nobody wants to be biased. And a juror in a very unusual and uncomfortable situation of speaking publicly in front of a courtroom full of strangers is never going to want to admit to that. So I don't use that word either when I'm talking to the jurors, but it's just strongly held beliefs and opinions. Mm-hmm. Sort of the unconscious way we think about things. That's what I think you're looking to try to identify in people, even when they may not be aware of it themselves.
Let's get more specific if we can. So you're facing a jury trial in a medical malpractice case, for example. In your mind, do you have the perfect jury already selected as you go in, or are there certain traits you're looking for? There's certain characteristics. What is going through your mind as you decide who's going to be serving on this important trial?
I think it's dangerous to identify potentially good jurors based on the facts of your case or demographics alone. I think that's a dangerous thing to do, because when you do that, you can miss people who appear on paper or on their social media, which is, you know, we definitely do that. Once we get the jury list, we spend time researching the jurors as much as we can, so we have a sense of what their public persona is. And you can have somebody who has a public persona that you might think, oh, this is going to be a great juror. They're intelligent, they're open-minded, that sort of thing. And then it ends up they're not, because they have some belief or opinion that's strong to them and their life experience that you can't see based on the demographics. I think it's shifted some. It used to be like some people who had very strong political beliefs or appeared in some ways to be difficult to persuade in one direction or another on either side, extremely liberal or extremely conservative. I think now I'm approaching jurors like that differently.
What's changed? How are you approaching them now?
Well, I think that there's definitely, especially after COVID, a more heightened suspicion towards hospitals, the medical practice, corporations, things like that from all sides in a way that is helpful to us. So you could have somebody who before might have seemed, you know, closed-minded and not open and potentially like a tort reform type juror, somebody who doesn't think people should bring lawsuits or that money should compensate for losses in a situation where it's not hard economic damages. Those are jurors we're afraid of in our line of work. And before, that alone would, you know, you might have made assumptions about that type of belief from the way someone portrays themselves publicly on social media and things like that. But now I think there's also, while that still exists, there's also among those, that demographic of people, a real distrust of corporations and doctors and hospitals, not just because of COVID, but just because of life experiences I think people are having in the medical care now that maybe, and maybe this is too hopeful, shifting that tide a little bit. And it makes actually speaking to the juror and seeing how they respond to you important in a way that you can't make a predetermined idea, like, I want this kind of juror. Because if you come in with that, you could choose a juror that you don't spend time talking to who has something, has a different perspective that you miss.
So do the rules where you practice, are you allowed a sort of a fulsome, robust process where you can spend some time with the individual jurors and delve into their backgrounds and try to understand their biases and their belief system? I mean, do you have that opportunity up in Alaska? Because we don't always in Georgia.
Right.
And some states don't allow jury selection at all.
Not at all. And if, like in federal court, most federal courts are very limited in how they allow, and as the same as our federal court is here. But we do, I think we're probably in a spectrum of none. And then, you know, there's also like Connecticut where you have individual voir dire of each juror and it takes 3 weeks to, you know, it's incredible.
Which makes my head spin off its shoulders to hear that. I can't imagine 3 weeks to strike a jury. I mean, you probably know more about these jurors than you do your own family after questioning them for 3 weeks.
A lot of time, I think. So we're kind of, I think, in the middle. It's not extremely limited. It's not extremely permissive. they bring them up in a panel. They do, the most judges, unless there's some sensitive issue, require you to address the panel sort of in the talk show host way, where you're talking to everybody at the same time, and then let you or the attorney drive asking specific questions or eliciting answers.
If you had a magic wand and could do it the way you think would be most effective for your client, what's your preference?
I like having the group. I would not actually like having the individual voir dire of each individual juror, because I think you're trying to build the group and build the cohesiveness of the jury in jury selection. And that's a super important thing in successful verdicts, is to have a group that is cohesive.
And do y'all have unanimous juries in Alaska?
No, it's 10 of 12. So we got that. That's good.
That is really good.
It is, except in federal court, of course.
Right, of course. Well, because in Georgia, we have unanimous 12. So we've got to get all 12 people on board. And, you know, it's hard to get 12 people to agree to much in this world, particularly in the past few years. But so I want to see you in action a little bit. So I'm going to enroll you as a lawyer starting a trial, and I will pretend I'm one of the panel members on your jury. And give us an idea of, let's just practice, and some of the questions you might ask, and I might surprise you with some answers.
Assuming I've already done the introductory part of things.
Exactly. I'm Meg Simonian. I practice here. Introduce your clients.
And one of the things that I always do with every panel is to elevate the service.
Tell us what you mean.
Well, I think that juries coming into a courtroom is one of the most incredible things about our democratic system, because it's so rare that strangers are brought together and empowered to do this important thing for absolute strangers. And there's not that many opportunities in most communities to engage in that way. And in fact, I can't think of a parallel like it. So the whole process to me is just sort of, in a way, special and magical. But then the jurors hate it. They come in there, they're angry, they're frustrated, they're tired of being made to wait. They don't want to be on the jury. So I feel like part of what I have to do in the beginning of every panel is make them understand how thankful I am that they're there and how special they are.
Yeah.
Like the reluctant heroes, kind of.
And how important their service is.
Yes.
Yeah. Sure.
And so I do that. I usually try to find out how many jurors were called and how many showed up. And so I tell them that at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I say, you know, you are all special because you came, you showed up. And these men, all, you know, you're the one of 40% who showed up, 60% didn't. And this is an important case, and it's important to my client. And we appreciate that you're here, that you showed up. And what we're doing here today is trying to find, and then I will say something too. I'll ask, why'd you show up?
Because I have a subpoena that says I will be arrested if I don't.
Right. And that's fair. But a lot of people got those and they didn't show up. So what was it about the subpoena that made you think this was something you had to do?
Well, what's behind that question, Meg? I've never heard that question before, but I like it.
Because I'm trying to get them to say, this is important. And if I had an important matter that came to court, I would want people, responsible people like me, to show up.
I think that's so smart and useful. And it ties into to ask them, say, well, you know, this system depends on all of us.
Yes.
So if you, God forbid, something happened to you or a family member where you need to pursue justice through our courtroom system, people need to show up for you or you or you. And now you're starting to enlist the jurors and letting them see through the lens that people care the most about, which is, what's in it for me? You know, how is this relevant to me? And I think what you're doing is so helpful to kind of get them to see it that way.
And in the end, part of my closing is reminding them how important this is, what their job is, how important it is. And so by in the beginning, it sort of just carries the theme through.
Yeah.
And it also values them. You know, my biggest fear here standing in front of you is that none of you are going to tell me anything. And this is my only time to talk to you. And I need to know these things. And I'm sorry that I have to ask you them in front of a courtroom of people with a judge with a black robe sitting up above you and a threat of subpoena if they said that. But I do, because it's such an important job that we have a fair fight.
Well, anybody who knows you is very dubious that it would be hard for you to get people to talk to you in a jury selection process. What I have found is how eager people are to talk about their experiences. We have all this anxiety of, well, if this question's too personal, let us know and we'll, you know, ask it privately if you don't feel like addressing it. Sometimes jurors will have something they want to bring up privately, but 99% of the time they are open about traumas and they've experienced really personal things and their health care they might share. I'm always shocked at how open people are. I think they just, it's because people just want to be listened to and heard. I think this is an environment where that can take place.
Yeah, it's one of the only, the uniqueness of the situation, I think, is important to recognize because it gives them permission, because mostly you want to do that, I think, give them permission to tell you things. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right. Like, I do think if you're the kind of person who can connect and communicate with someone, they will tell you things. But I've also been in situations with opposing counsel where they're not as open with opposing counsel because I don't know that they're able to make that sort of connection, or they're just asking a question that doesn't ask for a real open response. It's more directed and scripted, kind of.
Yeah, in conditioning where they're trying to sort of advocate the case and get you to say the right words and kind of lead you along. My experience is, I'd be curious if yours is the same, is that the defense lawyers just do not prioritize jury selection the way plaintiff's lawyers do, because I think we understand that it's so important to seat a fair jury, an open-minded jury, because if you don't, it doesn't matter how good your case is or how talented you are as an advocate, you're going nowhere if that jury doesn't have a buy-in and a commitment to being fair.
I think that's definitely true there. It's a much less involved task for the defense counsel because I think they make some assumptions about people's views towards lawsuits and plaintiffs in our line of practice, the medical malpractice, their allegiance and loyalty to their doctors and hospitals. So I do think it is more that plaintiff's lawyers probably fret and worry and spend a significant amount of time preparing for jury selection in a way that defense lawyers don't.
You mentioned that you try to elevate the process and help the jurors understand how important their service is. What else do you do that's uniquely Simonian in your jury approach?
I don't think anything is uniquely Simonian because I've stolen everything I do. Everybody, like you, like Rick, like I read all of the Nick Rowley approach. I try to use some of that Nick Rowley approach, which is that the fair fight type approach. And I say that at the very beginning, we're both looking for a fair fight. There are people who have strongly held beliefs that doctors are trying to help people and they should never be brought into court because ultimately they didn't intentionally hurt anyone. Other people feel that doctors have a duty to their patients to be reasonably careful and use reasonably careful skills and assessments. And it is appropriate. We need to find people who have the middle ground, who aren't strong one side or the other, who are willing to listen and evaluate the evidence as it comes in without that filter. So sometimes I will try to elicit, does anybody here feel that have really strong opinions against doctors because of a personal experience? Like, I try to elicit it. Mm-hmm. And then you can start talking to them about that. Does anybody feel one way or the other? If anybody raises their hands, I always raise my hand with them to try to get them to do that.
Lower the barriers a little bit.
Yeah.
You talked about how we are all being inspired by different people who have different things to offer. Nick Rowley has made great contributions in this area. Sari de Lamotte is another one I know that we've talked about. And one thing that you're doing that I've heard Sari talk about is providing context an explanation to the jury. So they're not just sitting there wondering, why are they asking me all these questions? And it's so helpful if you can say, well, this is a case that involves claims of medical malpractice. So I need to spend some time and talk to you about your experiences with our healthcare system. I think context, which you do naturally, is so important because now they're starting to understand. I used to, in my younger career, ask a lot of questions that I thought would give me great insight. You know, what kind of bumper sticker do you have on your car? Where do you get your news? Which, of course, is code for, you know, are you an MSNBC person or are you a Fox News person or something else? You know, to provide the context and so the jury starts understanding that what you're doing is important and relevant breaks down a lot of that resistance, which I think is kind of what you're touching on.
I do. I think it does that. And it also starts to help build your credibility, which, of course, is what we're trying to do all the time. And in almost every panel that I have done since I started using that method, I move for cause a juror who would be good for me.
Tell me about that. Well, for our non-lawyer listeners, explain a few of these terms. You move for cause. What do you mean?
Of course. So we have in Alaska, we have a 3 peremptory challenge rule usually per defendant. That means we get to pick 3 people we don't want and ask the judge to excuse them for any reason. But the judge has the duty to excuse a juror who doesn't meet the qualifications under the civil rules, which essentially says that they can be fair, to excuse them for cause. Asking the court to excuse a juror for cause is usually on the attorney who is doing the voir dire. Sometimes the judge will jump in if it's real obvious, but usually based on the questions that you ask with the juror, you can say to the judge, "Judge, I'm going to move for and ask that, you know, Mr. Bell be excused. Thank him for his service and ask that he be excused because of the statements he's made."
And is that done in front of the jury? I mean, do you have to?
Like sometimes it depends on the judge, and it depends on the process. Sometimes it does, but when I'm doing that, I say it in front of the jury because what they're saying is I'm going to be biased for you, and I know that the defense isn't going to object. And it sets up this great construct, right, where I've removed someone who's going to be biased from my client. They don't object. But then when it comes up later in the shoes on the defense's foot, they'll never do that.
Give me the most biased person in the world.
I really don't. But I'm not going to be in front of the jury, you know, trying to rehabilitate somebody who has been – that's not what I do. If somebody has – expressed clear bias and not answered in a way that meets the qualifications of a fair jury or a fair fight, then I'm not going to get up and try to rehabilitate them.
Well, and you're building your credibility up in front of the jury that you're fair and you're honest and you're decent.
Yes.
And you're not going to look for every advantage at the expense of your credibility. Because of course, you know, we could have a whole podcast on the topic of credibility and how important it is. If you do make a misstep or say something that undermines your credibility, you know, you've really jeopardized your case. Thanks for joining us today. We still have more ground to cover, so stay tuned for the next episode where we wrap up our conversation with Meg Simonian.